Welcome to WISH, the Women's International Summit for Health. By listening to this interview, you agree to the terms and conditions outlined at www.wishsummit.com/terms. For now, we invite you to pull out your pen and paper, get cozy, and prepare yourself for the adventure of watching your wishes come true.
There are pills you can pop and drips you can drop through an intravenous if you have to. There are mastectomies and biopsies, lumpectomies, and other atrocities to the human body and spirit that can be performed when cancer strikes. But somehow, in spite of all our technological advances and innovative inventions to combat cancer, we're left scratching our heads mysteriously wondering how and why this has happened. Having researched the records back 15,000 years to prehistoric times, then up through Egyptian papyrus, Lynn Farrow uncovered some vital information for women's health and details about a golden age of iodine in the 1800s. Her own determination to win the battle against breast cancer led her to uncover the details of how iodine, a key factor in restoring health and preventing disease, had been stolen. Here to bring it back, along with a huge dose of optimism about what you can do to improve and restore your health, is Lynn Farrow. Lynn, thank you so much for being here with us, and welcome to WISH.
Wow, thank you for covering this subject.
It's a big one, and I would love it if you could start by sharing with us a little bit about your story, because this is a subject that is near and dear to your heart in more ways than one.
Yes, well, how I got into iodine was I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I began to try to do research and check the treatments that were prescribed for me to see if there was evidence there. And what I found was a lot of the treatments were consensus-based, which means that's basically that a lot of doctors had agreed on it and had published the guidelines. And then I looked at those guidelines for the evidence, and I found it not compelling enough for me. So I, in pursuing an alternative route, I ran across a doctor called Dr. Sherry Tenpenny at a medical conference, and she said, oh, you have that organization, Breast Cancer Choices. Do you know about iodine? And I sort of rolled my eyes, and I thought, iodine, you know, this is almost insulting. I've looked at every possible therapy that's been used, and because I had done a lot of research up until then, and she said, you know, you have to look at fibrocystic breast disease, and there may be a connection there. And then again, I rolled my eyes, and I thought, fibrocystic breast disease, that doesn't have anything to do with breast cancer. That's a benign form of disease. Your breasts just are swollen, or they have cysts, or they hurt. So because it was Dr. Tenpenny, who is a highly respected vaccine educator, when I left the conference, I set aside a couple of weeks to review the medical literature on iodine in the breast. And after 2 weeks, I had found so much, I thought, you know, this is going to require more time. And I gave it 2 months, and then that turned into 2 years, and then that turned into my book, The Iodine Crisis.
So talk to us, because that's, thank you for sharing that, and I'm already mouth wide open, and what happened next?
Well, when I began doing the research, I started in the current day, in the last 20 years or so, and then I found there was published research that went back even further in time. And as I went back into the 1800s, there was a whole golden age of iodine use, and I dug up some old medical books, and I found that they were actually injecting iodine into the breast. They were applying iodine as a solution to the exterior of the breast to try to shrink tumors or to shrink the swelling, anything that was made a sick breast, iodine was on the scene then. So this was really well known in the 1800s, especially, say, 1832, 1930. Wow. So then I thought, gee, I wonder if seaweed-based iodine is back there in the literature. And sure enough, I went back even to the Middle Ages, and people were using seaweed and burnt sponges as a breast remedy. And then I went back even further to the Egyptian papyrus, and there's some medical papyruses that just go through medical remedies at the time that they had recorded. And it was in traditional Chinese medicine, which are going back, you know, 3,000 years B.C. And then finally, I went even further, and I looked at the archaeology literature, and it, you could find how seaweeds were used medicinally back 15,000 years, that they uncovered as they would do a dig, an excavation, and they would find these little medical huts where there was discrete sections where they had the different remedies. So that's how I followed back in the history. But then I shot back to the present, and I found out that iodine was removed from flour in 1970, which means it was removed from bread as well. And that wasn't, that would have been bad enough because, you know, if you have a few slices of bread, even the worst bread, you're really getting, you would get back then a lot of iodine. But it was replaced with something called bromide. And bromide is an anti-iodine. So you have one iodine is removed, two bromide is added, and the third thing is a huge introduction of brominated fire retardants. So you have three things here that are kind of perfect storm for iodine deficiency. And in that same framework, say 1970 to 2000, you have a huge rise in breast cancer from 1 in 23 to 1 in 7, or even in some places 1 in 6.
Was the iodine in bread naturally occurring?
No, it wasn't. It was used to fortify the bread. It wasn't natural. It started probably, they started it when in some places iodized salt wasn't good enough, or the iodine in salt evaporates a lot, so it was very little iodine in salt.
So did you look in and find out who took it out and when and why?
Well, there was some, you know, I've been trying to find a graduate student who will help me with that research because I've been trying to figure it out for about 7 years now. The baking companies seem to have taken it out because they thought iodine, we were getting too much iodine and it was a poison and it would build up. But also at the same time, you couldn't do a CAT scan if somebody was sufficient in iodine. So, in other words, you almost had to be iodine deficient in order for a CAT scan, the radio, you know, the iodine that's in the dye, for that to trace out where the pathology was. So there was some pressure from the medical profession to have people have less iodine.
I feel like iodine with antioxidants, with omega fatty acids, with calcium, with K2, with vitamin D, with, it feels like as we learn and start to empower ourselves about the health of our bodies, there's so much, and there's so much misinformation we have to filter through. So I would love you to just kind of talk to us about, well, what is iodine? How is it working in the body? Because before we talk into, you know, about what deficiencies are causing and maybe even what are some of the things we need to consider when we're supplementing, just help us understand what iodine is and how it functions in the body so that we can start to empower ourselves about the basics that seem to kind of get lost in the mud of marketing out there.
Iodine is an essential element. You have iodine in every cell of your body, and you need it to live. It's particularly concentrated in the thyroid, we know that, but it's also concentrated in the skin and the stomach and the ovaries, and particularly in the breasts. So you really need it. You can't be allergic to the element iodine, otherwise you would be allergic to yourself. Now, in terms of nutrition, you might be able to get, before 1970, you may have been able to get along fine without iodine. But iodine deficiency, and that's the iodine crisis, is caused by an anti-iodine out there. It's just not that we accidentally are not taking enough of a particular nutrient. It's that nutrient has been purged out of our diet by this ubiquitous presence of bromides in some foods, but it definitely in fire retardants.
Now, and part of that is because they compete with each other or something like that at their receptor site, right?
Yes.
Can you explain to us why this element bromide is causing us a problem?
Yes, that's the heart of the whole iodine crisis. What happens is iodine and bromine chlorine and fluoride all are in the same category of elements. If you look at the chart of elements, you can see that they're all the same category, which is halides. Now, one will compete with the other. If you get too much bromide, it purges iodine, just like fluoride also will help purge iodine out there. So if iodine didn't have the competition, we probably wouldn't have a deficiency.
So then can taking iodine help push out the bromine and the fluoride?
Yes, because they're competitive. And the thing is to try to get so bromide doesn't dominate the halide family. You have receptors that don't distinguish between them, the good halides and the bad halides. So if you overpower the bromide and fluoride, for example, you won't have the problem. So the iodine pushes those bad halides out of your body. It knocks them off the receptor.
And we know there was a call at the beginning of the series that really talks about how fluoride and is causing us a problem. And so it's good to understand that we can start to eliminate harmful metals and things like this by taking iodine. I wonder, what do we need to know about the cofactors, the things that work in harmony with iodine to help it do its job?
The companion nutrients or the cofactors just help iodine get into the cell, but they also help the bad halides and toxins and even to some extent heavy metals get out of the tissue. So it's very important to have the companion nutrients. Selenium is probably the most important companion nutrient, especially for your thyroid. You just don't start taking iodine willy-nilly. You have to take the whole protocol.
And do you go into detail about that protocol in your book, The Iodine Crisis?
Yes, I lay out the whole protocol and what to do if you have any detox symptoms, because some people can take it too fast and you just get an excretion of bromide that will, you know, give you a headache or a runny nose or something like that. And we have something called the salt water protocol. And what that does is it sort of clamps on or traps the bromide that's being forced out of your tissues and excretes it through the urine.
Okay. And I think it's also kind of related to the pink spots that we can get on our skin sometimes.
Yes. Cherry angiomas is one of the things that people who are exposed to bromide get. Sometimes you'll get a new mattress, they have been filled with bromide fire retardants, and people will report that they get these little, they look like the head of the pin, little cherry spots, mostly on your trunk, but it could be anywhere on your body. But that is often one of the things people get on a temporary basis when they take iodine, because iodine is forcing out the bromide. But that will go away.
Okay. So let's talk about when iodine is deficient, aside from understanding that fluoride is moving in or bromine is moving in, what happens? How does this start to show up as something we can recognize affecting our health, energy, well-being?
Well, one of the ways, I think I was a little typical. Before I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I was going around, I had a slight brain fog, I had headaches, I gained weight very easily, I had very dry skin, and people would just say, oh, well, you know, everybody has dry skin. Look at the chain drugstores. They're filled with hand lotions and skin creams. And I was also, you know, I just sleep all the time. My family called me Rip Van Winkle. So I had been to doctors, and they would give me thyroid medicine, but it really never did anything until I took iodine. And then gradually everything, all my symptoms, the brain fog, the dry skin, the sleeping all the time, the headaches, they all went away. As a matter of fact, the first time I took 50 milligrams of iodine to take an iodine loading test, which is a urine test that measures the amount of iodine you have. When I took that 50 milligrams, an hour and a half later, my head cleared. And we call it the boing effect. It doesn't affect everybody. Not everybody gets this boing. But just the mental clarity was so powerful. It wasn't a stimulant like coffee or anything like that. It was just a clarity that had been missing for so many years. I was very surprised by that I could actually think that clearly.
So brain fog, and start to give us the link in how this starts to translate into being such a huge issue for breast cancer, because you mentioned that when you went back and looked at the records, even way back into the Middle Ages, then you were noticing it being used specifically for breast treatments. What's the connection here?
Well, after the thyroid, most of the iodine you take is taken up by the thyroid for most people. The breasts require a huge amount of iodine, and this is probably because the breasts are nature's baby food factory. They have to be developed so we'll be able to pass on nutrients to the baby. And I found out in the literature, the medical literature and the archaeological literature, just going back in the records, that iodine was always used for this. And then, of course, contemporary science has found, like, there's a kind of hierarchy, thyroid, breasts, ovaries, uterus, testes, you know, skin, stomach, all these things that take up iodine.
Okay. It's interesting because since you talked about the little cherry and angiomas,
yes,
I have the picture of my partner's back in my head, which has all those little red dots all over it, and it's probably coming from the mattress. Oh,
yes.
It's so amazing.
Well, think how much time you spend on a mattress, and the fire retardant just falls off into the dust and comes and touches your skin, and you inhale it as well. So even if you don't have, you know, besides your mattress, your couch, there's actually articles that have been written, is your couch making you sick? Is your couch making you fat? Because the chemicals, the fire retardant chemicals, break off into the dust and you inhale it.
Jeez, these aren't little risks, are they? Even though we just kind of live with them in our air and in our environment and on our skin, we take for granted the degree to which they're getting in the body.
Yes, I mean, some people have actually studied just fire retardants and how important it is, especially for firefighters, because don't forget, they go into fires and people's rugs are on fire and their drapes and their sofas and stuff, and they have to inhale those fire retardants, so they have a much higher rate of cancer than the normal person.
So let's talk a little bit about supplementation and where we can get iodine and in what kinds. I know you have a specific protocol, so it's important to understand the things that are linked to it. And I think it's like around, anyway, I know in your book around page 120 or something like that is the protocol for the for how to start using it. But let's start to make it accessible for us and understand ways that we can either be eating with our foods and starting to include more iodine awareness into our lifestyle.
Well, you can't, unfortunately, Tara, I really wish I could say, oh, just get some seaweed and you'll be fine. You'll have it a couple of times a day. But seaweed has become so contaminated now with the bromides, with pesticides, with oil spill dispersants and stuff like that, that seaweed isn't a safe source of iodine. The only way you can really get it is to supplement with something called Lugol solution, which was invented in the early 1800s. That's Lugols. And it's a water-based iodine product. It can't be patented. That's why it's so cheap. It's potassium iodide and potassium iodine. Now, you can get that on Amazon. It's on eBay. There are a lot of very reputable companies that make it. One of the oldest companies is J. Crowe's, and they're very reliable. But there's also Lugol's tablets, and that's Iodorol. The main brand is Iodorol. That also is all over the internet. You just Google Iodorol, and that will come up. So if it's more convenient for you to take the tablet, you know, that's the way to go. But that's the main way of supplementing, is with Lugol's or Lugol's tablets in the form of Iodorol. But also be sure to look up the protocol and make sure you have the companion nutrients at the same time.
Terms like Iodorol make me nervous because it sounds like a pharmaceutical name. Why? Like when you say potassium iodide, then I'm more comfortable. So what is Iodorol?
Iodorol is just the element of iodine combined with potassium. and it, you know, it's been around for years and years. You don't have to use the iodorol. The only reason they invented iodorol is because it has a pharmaceutical glaze on it that protects the stomach. About 15 or 20% of people taking Lugols get some sort of stomach irritation. So that's why it was invented.
Hmm. Okay. So I was going to ask you, because I know what happens is that, especially in the field of natural health, someone starts to make a fuss about something and then everybody is selling it. And I know the bottle of iodine that I have in my cupboard, first of all, when I first started hearing about it, I didn't supplement with any other cofactors. And but it says nascent iodine. What does that mean?
Nobody is really sure what nascent iodine is, but it's not the traditional iodine that's been used for 175 years. Some people like it because it gives them a little pickup in the morning. It may be magnetized. It's not really clear what nascent is. It's some variation. Of course, when things become popular, people start reinventing the wheel from the old traditional to adding things or processing things differently. And nascent is one of those either improvements or variations, you know, however you want to look at it.
What is the best way to take it? You've talked about this little pharmaceutical coating for the iodorol that makes it easy to ingest. I know some people put it directly on their skin. What ways do you recommend we take it?
Well, either way, whichever is more convenient for you. Iodorol is more expensive because it's tableted and it has that glaze. If you're on a budget, you can get Lugol's iodine for $10 or $12 or $15 on the internet. Where, you know, if you can afford it, the iodorol tablets are available for a little more expensive, but they certainly are convenient.
It's interesting because when you said Lugol solution, it's almost like a word I heard in my childhood that I kind of forgotten about or something, but sounds like so familiar, almost like borax or those old cleaning solution kind of things.
Yes, yes. The thing is, it may have been in your grandmother's medicine chest because it was around for many, many years. And in doing my research, I bought up some pharmacy registers from the 1920s, 1930s, and they were filled with the actual prescriptions that doctors wrote to give to make sure that patients were given iodine. And even veterinary medicine, they used a lot of Lugol's solution. So it may have been that you did actually see a bottle of Lugol's iodine around.
Amazing. And how cool, back when doctors prescribed things like iodine instead of...
Yes, yes. I mean, one of my veterinary medicine books, it's written by a vet to other vets, and it says, well, if you use the Lugol's iodine on the horse's foot, you won't have to operate. It'll be like a substitute for surgery to get the infection out or something like that. Wow. And the vet was recommending to other vets, well, since you got the same results, it should be the same charge, even though you've probably used 10 cents worth of iodine as compared to an actual surgical procedure.
Mm. And I guess once we have a medical system where it's profitable to be sick and have surgeries, then simple quick fix solutions kind of get sidelined.
Yes, it's amazing that sometimes the simplest remedy cures profound things that we didn't understand. One of the things the point I tried to make in the book, because iodine has become so well known very fast, and the reason it has is because it gets results. Iodine is not a hot new topic. It's the oldest traditional medicine that we have. You know, going back to algae and seaweed. So if people that scratch their heads and say, iodine, it can't be that simple. Well, once you try it, you see how complex it is and how wide-ranging it is.
One of the things that might be helpful and inspiring for us is to hear some of the stories or things that you've observed when iodine supplementation started to come in.
Well, one of the things that when I was writing the book, first of all, I had been in the iodine movement since it started, and when we all were experimenting early on, reports began to come in. So I saved some of the reports, and I contacted the people, and they gave me their stories. But then I solicited more. I went on the internet to the various iodine sites, and I said, if you have a medical history or a story that you could tell me about, I'd really think people would like to hear it. And I just got a flood of reports, and this was so moving to me. It was life-changing because I didn't know there were that many profoundly sick people out there, and that iodine could really change lives as much as it did. Now, there was a young mother who wrote me. She had three children, and she and worked, and she would come home from work, and she just like want to fall into bed because she didn't have the energy to make any dinner for her family, and her husband had to do everything around the house, and he worked also. And she said within a week, all of a sudden, like a light bulb went out, and she felt she could, you know, like cook again and do the things that she, a normal person, would do. But the people that have been written to me about ovarian cysts, that they were, you know, scheduled to have a hysterectomy or their ovaries, you know, they've had ovarian cysts just, you know, melt away after a few months. They've had eczema go away. One of the breast cancer patients was taking iodine as a therapy, as in what they call an adjuvant therapy. After you have surgery, you take something, and she was taking it for that. And the psoriasis she had since she was 13 years old went away. And she was very confused by this because she hadn't researched it a whole lot, and she thought iodine was just being used for the breast. And so to see other things happen, dry eyes happen. The most important thing for me, I know I used it for breast cancer, but as one of the things that helps cells not divide and the good cells to die off, was my brain suddenly changed. Iodine deficiency is the leading cause of mental retardation in the world, and I didn't think I had any particular mental deficits other than this brain fog. So a lot of people said that too. They wrote and said, I can think more clearly now. So that was very rewarding. And there we have some people who have autistic children. They find the children are able to focus more and speak more in a more intimate way, a more connected way.
We have an autistic child.
Oh.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions, or do you address protocol for children in your book?
No, I don't in this edition, but when I do another edition in a couple of years, I'll include the protocol that the iodine doctors have for children. I know with kids with autism, you have to go very, very slowly and think of it as in terms of months or a year in working up.
So interesting. I feel like you've answered a lot of questions and addressed some important things, and that at a certain point it's time for us to roll up our sleeves and get the book and read it and understand. What more would you like us to know about the iodine crisis and how it's affecting our health and what we can do to improve the situation?
Well, I don't think when people hear the word iodine, their eyes glaze over. They don't understand how something so small and seemingly insignificant could be a life changer. And some of the reviews of my book have said the information in this book changed my life. So my main thing is, don't be like me when Sherry Tenpenny said, Lynn, look into iodine. Don't roll your eyes. Think maybe there's something to this. And just consider that you might be one of the people whose lives it changes or improves or gives some benefit, because everyone is bombarded with bromides, the anti-iodine. So it's absolutely essential that people be protected. And we're trying to prevent breast cancer. One of the things that they found is that, you know, when you have fibrocystic breast disease, that's swollen, tender, or painful breasts, a third of the time, according to the Mayo Clinic, that seemingly benign disease will and can progress to breast cancer. So you really can't take a chance. You don't want fibrocystic breast disease to progress, to be like almost a degenerative disease the way they've showed it to be in rats. So the thing is to try to reverse fibrocystic breast disease, which we've had virtually 100% of the people do in a period between 2 weeks and 2 years. So it's very important, you know, rethink the pink. Try to prevent it. Try to get precancerous conditions to just resolve so it doesn't go anywhere.
I love that you're saying this about sometimes people's eyes kind of glaze over. And so much of that, in my opinion, has to do with marketing. And we've included as a bonus interview in this series a call with Jean Kilborn, who did an amazing presentation on media literacy called Killing Us Softly.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are so heavily bombarded by 3,000 media messages per day telling us what to buy and how to look and how shiny our hair should be, just because there's not big, because the more money that can be made off of something, the more expensive the ad campaign can be.
So yes.
When there's little profit to be made, then the pom-poms are quiet, and there's never going to, even though going for a walk is a perfectly acceptable cure for mild to moderate clinical depression, you're never going to see a billboard that says, hey, why don't you go for a walk? And so it's the same kind of thing. And I feel like as women who are trying to reappropriate some degree of responsibility and control over our own health, we have to be willing to move against the grain and think for ourselves and do more than just talk and listen, but actually apply the information and start to see the results and figure these things out for ourselves. But if we just get seduced into the next great talk or the next, you know, convincing health guru who gets up and pitches another supplement sale, then we overlook the fact that often the simplest solutions are the only solutions we need.
Yeah, you raise a good point here that we are so bombarded with the next new supplement. It's very easy to just say, oh, yeah, and glaze over. And that's why we have to do, to empower ourselves to think, yes, we can investigate this ourselves. We can look into this. We can find other people that are investigating at the same time. Like you're doing with this summit is bringing all these minds together and letting people evaluate from themselves what value this information is. But certainly the information is more important than any supplement. And once you have that information, you can really take off with it and change your life.
Mm. There were many women that I interviewed for this series whose calls I did not publicize because not knowing their situation before interviewing, once I spoke with them, I realized how few solutions they had, how hopeless it seemed for them, how having a breast cancer diagnosis meant a death sentence. And what I think is just so important to understand is that there are solutions, that it isn't your DNA is not your destiny, your diagnosis is not a death sentence, that there are things that can be done. And what I love about what you've said is let's not wait until we're standing at death's door to wonder what we can do. Although even if we are, there is still some thing that we can do, but to now, when we have the information and we have the time and we have the energy and we have the attention, to prioritize prevention and self-care so that we can maintain a high level of health for the long haul.
Yes, it's really information like this is really an investment. I mean, you can embrace it and you can apply it and you can really move on and not feel helpless, because I saw so many people when I was diagnosed that just wanted to know essentially what the recipe was for curing themselves. And as you said, the solutions for breast cancer that are out there are very crude and simple-minded, but they're not really investigating cause and they're not looking at anything else but the standard of care. They have a paradigm, which is radiation and chemotherapy, and they're not really stressing what else could be done. What, even if you choose that route, what else can you do? It's very crude. The menu is very short. And it's really not enough if you want to empower yourself.
Mm. Yeah, we have to get out of the quick fix marketing and get into a little more roll up your sleeves and sweat and do it and work. But part of it is because that quick fix has been so profitable for so many people that we've kind of we've been seduced into that methodology rather than the sleuthing and searching and investigating and uncovering and discovering. And then, you know, the victory of finding the answers, we're really like, well, quick, what's the thing I need to swallow to make this all go away?
Yes, I think people in an emergency situation want it over fast, and they're not even that concerned if it's effective or not. The anxiety that a diagnosis of cancer brings on makes people just rush to the nearest expert. Mm-hmm. It's because the anxiety is so painful. But if you investigate even the slightest bit, you will see the limitations, and you can find the evidence for yourself. And it certainly is out there what can be done for you, and to try to broaden that as much as possible. Like you talked about walking for depression and the things like that. There's so much out there about how just exercise reduces your recurrence of breast cancer profoundly, how losing weight reduces the possibility of recurrence. And you don't hear that from your mainstream oncologist, and they just don't write prescriptions for that.
Good lessons, and we see them coming up as much in the field of ADD, depression, breast cancer. The same kind of lessons keep repeating themselves, so hopefully we'll figure it out. I would love for you to just let us know, where would you like us to get a hold of your book? Amazon or your website? What's the best place for us to...
Amazon.com is probably the best place to get it. You could get either the paperback or the Kindle version. It's also on the Nook and Kobo, so it's out there. You just Google the iodine crisis and my name, or just the iodine crisis, and it will pop up. It's selling very well. It's going into its fourth printing now in less than a year. So I just wanted the message to get out there. I'm passionate about this. It's helped me. It's helped many other people. And people connect with this message. And because it has results, that's why the book has sold so well. And that's why this message has gone around the world.
And also give us your website so that we can keep up to date with what you've got going on and any articles or other things that you've contributed.
Yes, I can be reached at Lynn, that's Lynne, Farrow, Farrow, .net. Also, a really good place if you just want to hang out and discuss with other iodine takers is our Facebook group called Iodine Workshop. We have a lot of people on there that are very knowledgeable, more than 2,000 people now, and there's a lot of people that are just new, that haven't ever taken iodine and just heard about it yesterday, that kind of thing. So it's a good place just to get information, you know, quietly and know that the information is reliable.
Well, I feel like we've covered the key points, and this certainly for me has been I kind of wanted to lead into this grand finale because it came up in so many of our interviews throughout the series, the importance of looking into this. So what I want to do is just thank you for your sleuthing and searching and detecting and discovering and then willingness to boldly share this information and generously share this information with the world.
Thank you, Tara. I'm just so excited that you're covering it, and because I know you'll reach a lot of people with this.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And what I would love to do is just, if you have nothing else you'd like to add, then I'd love to just hit you up with one more question.
Sure.
This is our WISH Summit, Women's International Summits for Health. So I like to end every interview by asking you, what is your wish for women?
My wish for women is that they wouldn't take people's word for the expert's word for everything, but they would just go out and try to investigate more themselves. I think women should just be empowered investigators. That would be my main wish. And in listening to your summit, I'm sure that you're going to get nothing but people who already have this mindset. So that's very exciting to me, is that, you know, you continue your work and women embrace that philosophy.
Well, thank you so much for contributing to this cause and for the work that you've done and sharing your time and your attention with us. It's been an awesome call, and we do look forward to seeing what comes next.
Yes. Well, thank you so much.